This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Big news! One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please, give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate. The past 5 days in this economy, four letters are key. J, O, B, and S. We'll go over some other stuff, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today. This one is the very first day of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It is not only jobs that we're going to discuss for the next 6.5, 7 or so minutes. There has been a relative ton of economic news this week. But jobs are where we're going to start. Anna Swanson's at the New York Times. Heather Long is at the Washington Post. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Heather, everybody's heard the numbers by now. 3.8% on the rate, 187,000 on new jobs last month. Strong but cooling, I think, is what you tweeted out this morning.
That's certainly the takeaway, but it's still just remarkable to see these jobs reports come out month after month with what it just feels like more and more new records, another record for prime age women, labor force participation, near record unemployment lows for Black and Hispanic workers, wage inequality is going down, wages are still outpacing inflation. You love to see it. At the end of the day, this is what we all wanted. We don't want to be in a situation where the job market is so hot that it's pressuring inflation higher and we have to live in a crazy world of more Fed rate hikes. So it's good to see the data today and that Goldilocks, not too hot, not too cold. But I think at the end of the day, it's just as we're sitting here on Labor Day weekend, this is a labor market to celebrate.
Anna Swanson, I will submit to you that inflation is steady and, in fact, falling in some measures. GDP is cooling nicely. Thank you very much. What's not to love, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to love. The economy is really in a pretty sweet spot, really resilient, but still showing some of the signs of moderation that the Fed is going to want to see to know that higher interest rates are having an effect. You talked about job gains, the unemployment rate ticking up for good reasons as people came in. Consumers are still strong. Wage growth is pretty soft. From the Fed's perspective, that kind of slowly decelerating but strong job market is really what they want to see. Still, there's a little more work to do and definitely some risk. I was kind of skeptical of a soft landing scenario, and I'm still not sure that's the most likely. But the last few months have definitely made me think it's possible. We just need to keep going like this for many more months in order for that to be true.
Say more, Anna, about what you think the risks are.
Well, we did see the PCE index, the Fed's preferred inflation measure, tick up just a little bit this week to 3.3% from 3% the month earlier. It's down a lot from last summer, but it's still above where the Fed wants it to be. It looks like that's more likely a bump in the road rather than a change in direction. But we still need to keep going in the right direction, as I was saying.
So, Heather, we had Heather Boucher from the Council of Economic Advisors on the program yesterday to talk about, how the Biden administration is seeing this economy. And she and I talked, and as you have pointed out, this economy is really strong right now. And so I asked her sort of on the way out of the interview, how come if the economy is so strong, President Biden is having to work so hard to get credit for it. The most recent AP poll shows like 39% of Americans, just 39%, think the president's doing a good job on the economy. And her answer in part was, well, look, we just got out of a recession. I'm sorry, we just got out of a pandemic, and it's really hard to bounce back. And as I was listening back to the interview last night, it occurred to me that I should have stopped her there and said, wait a minute, pandemic's been over for a year plus. Is it really still fair to blame the pandemic for the state of the economy today? And I guess that's my question to you. Is it fair?
Yeah, well, the problem is this is the best argument that they've got, right? That we're still in a bit of a hangover, a vibe hangover, you know, that the perception is still gloomy, but the momentum and the data and the hard facts are looking better and better and better. When I think their word of the day, if you're in the White House, is momentum, and the momentum is going in the right direction. You know, I think on a bigger picture level, you know, there's obviously on a very tangible level, prices and of cars and homes and mini goods are still really high. Yes, they're not growing in price like they were a year ago, but people still go to the store or go and look at for a home, and you're like, I can't afford this. How is this going to work? And that hasn't changed significantly right now yet. I think the other big problem they have is selling this industrial policy.
Right.
You know, that's their signature: more green energy jobs, more chips jobs, high-tech manufacturing. And what they've done and what they're doing is pumping a lot of money into companies and specific cities. So if you're in Phoenix or you're in Syracuse where they're building a chip factory, this seems really exciting and great. But if you're in Iowa or parts of Pennsylvania, you're not feeling it. You're not seeing the tangible effects. And the parts of Bidenomics that didn't get enacted are things like paid parental leave, universal pre-K childcare and early child education, a free community college plan, things that would have really impacted almost every American family overnight. And so I think they're going to still struggle to sell this industrial policy as a policy that's really benefiting all Americans.
Right. It's the what have you done for me, me lately, right? That's the deal. Go ahead, Ani.
Those are great points. I don't think you can discount the difficulty people have felt from higher prices, higher rents, wages that took a while to kick into gear. I mean, that's very real for a lot of people. And then I also think there's a lag when it comes to the experience of industrial policy. So now we're seeing clear signs that the tax credits and subsidies for clean energy and chips are encouraging more investment. Manufacturing construction spending, for example, has more than doubled in a little over the last year. But, you know, that's just sort of starting to filter into communities. So I think that, you know, takes a little while for people to feel that effect as well.
On a real quick, I just want to touch on the trip you're just back from with Secretary Raimondo to China, the Secretary of Commerce, of course, the latest in the string of Biden cabinet officials to go. First of all, what was your sense of how she was received? And do you think the message that the administration is trying to land, which is we're going to look out for our national security, but we need to stay economically coupled, do you think that's landing?
Yeah, she was received pretty warmly. I do think that that message that you're talking about is a very tricky message to convey, that, you know, we're eager to trade in some areas and really not willing to trade in other areas. And, you know, what about the areas in the middle? I mean, there's a lot of gray space in the middle there. So I do think there's a lot of optimism in China and in the U.S. about reestablishing some communications after a pretty rocky year. I'm just not sure how far outside of the meeting rooms that we were in, that optimism is going to extend, because, you know, there's the geopolitical tensions. Companies in China are facing a lot of factors on the ground, like recent raids on foreign businesses. And Secretary Raimondo also, she set up a couple dialogues while we were over there with the Chinese, including one over commercial issues. But the history of these dialogues is, it's kind of where tricky issues go to be talked to death. And in fact, one of the issues she brought up during her trip is Visa and MasterCard. That's been under discussion for 22 years. So, you know, she made the point that talking is not a bad thing, but, and I think that's probably correct, but we'll see how much comes out of some of these dialogues. Yeah.
Ana Swanson at the New York Times and Heather Long at the Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today to end the week and start a new month. It was fine. You know, details, numbers, when we get there. One of the data points that really popped in this morning's jobs report, and Heather alluded to it, was something called the labor force participation rate. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is going to explain what that is and why it matters after I tell you the last month the LFPR rose 0.2% to 62.8% after basically not budging for 5 months. It's now the highest it's been since the pandemic hit. It has not quite caught up to where it was in the before times, but it is getting pretty darn close. Here's Mitchell.
Labor force participation is one of those economic terms that can kind of fly by your brain without sticking. So let me try a simple definition here. It's the percentage of the adult population, age 16 and up, that's got a job or is actively looking for one. It doesn't include people in the military or in prison or the elderly in nursing homes. And in general, we want higher labor force participation, because it means more people are working and making money, or at least trying to. So here's what's been happening.
More Americans entered the labor force looking for work in August.
Bill Adams at Comerica Bank says that pushed labor force participation up, but also unemployment.
In an economy experiencing labor shortages, a higher unemployment rate is a sign that there are more workers out looking for jobs, which is good news.
Participation has been rising among people 55 and older, also among women 25 to 54, many of whom stopped working when childcare and schooling got so hard in the pandemic, says Becky Frankowitz at staffing firm Manpower Group.
We've done a lot of research with women as well as returning retirees. And what has caused them to come back into the labor force is, one, the pay, I can make more money. But two is the flexibility, part-time, full-time, or even more, the hybrid opportunity for workplace and home.
Other groups are boosting the labor force too, says Bill Adams, immigrants.
And then we're also seeing a big increase in labor force participation among Americans with disabilities.
Because, he says, it's now easier to work from home with assistive devices and without commuting. More teenagers looked for work in August, though not a lot of them found jobs right away. And that's a risk, says Dana Peterson at the conference board.
We have to keep an eye on that if we continue to see people jumping in, but still not being able to work.
Because it could drive unemployment, especially long-term unemployment, higher down the road. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, so it's not necessarily any of my business, but how you feeling? I ask because, as Heather and Anna and I were talking about, the job market is still really healthy. The economy is growing, respectably. Inflation is down and falling, all of which put the United States in a stronger economic position than every other developed economy on the planet. Thing is, those numbers, and maybe most particularly GDP, economic growth, don't tell you how people actually feel. Regular listeners to this program know that I'm a history guy. So I'm going to tell you a little history now about gross domestic product, and we start back in the 1930s.
The close of an era. The great big spree, the jazz age, is over. All over.
That's from a documentary called Life in the 30s.
Depression.
Unemployment hit 24.9%. Back then, though, the government didn't really publish economic data like it does today. And that made it hard to gauge just how far the economy had fallen or what the path to recovery might be. So enter gross domestic product.
Now every train to Washington brings its cargo of experts to join the great assault on the Depression. Economists, sociologists, statisticians, agronomists, idealists.
In 1932, the Department of Commerce started working on a new way to measure the economy that would eventually become GDP. An economist named Simon Kuznets was in charge, and by 1936, Franklin Roosevelt was using his figures in the State of the Union.
Restoration of national income, which shows continuing gains for the third successive year.
That might not seem like a big deal today, but at the time, very nearly revolutionary. Policymakers now had a single number they could use to sum up a country's economy. And then a decade later,
at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, delegates from 44 allied and associate countries arrived for the opening of the United States.
GDP became the standard measuring tool for economies around the world.
These meetings are designed to promote trade in the post-war world.
Kuznets later won a Nobel Prize in part for his work on measuring national economies. But economists have long realized that GDP has its limits. Kuznets among them. He wrote when he first presented his data to Congress, here's the quote, "The welfare of a nation can scarcely be inferred from a measure of national income." So GDP can tell you the dollar value of all the goods and services a country produces, but there's a lot it doesn't include: unpaid household work, for instance, or the value of skills that workers learn, or, most fundamentally, how people actually feel. That's why there's a movement now to find ways of measuring the economy that go beyond GDP.
The U.S. is pretty behind.
Amanda Janew is the economic and policy lead for a group called the Well-Being Economy Alliance. That's more than 400 organizations around the world pushing to change the paradigm of how economies are measured.
I fully believe we have the statistical capacities to do it. But I think the point is just to be clear on where are we trying to go and what are we trying to achieve as people.
There are countries that are trying different things. Canada has developed a quality of life framework based on 84 key metrics of well-being. They include stuff like job satisfaction and trust in others.
And then a new budgeting system where there's allocating spending according to impact in those well-being domains.
Of course, not every country is going to measure well-being the same way.
I'm Steve Landfeld, former director of the Bureau of Economic Analysis.
The Bureau of Economic Analysis is whence GDP data comes. Steve Landfeld ran it for almost 20 years, and he has been thinking about this problem since the beginning of his career.
And it was a hot topic back then in the 1970s.
It's an even hotter topic now.
From all directions, the keepers of the GDP have had pressure to change GDP from this measure of the market economy to one that measures economic welfare.
In 2020, the BEA started publishing a dashboard of what they call prototype statistics aimed at measuring economic well-being and growth.
What we're proposing is a set of supplementary accounts, but the core GDP remains untouched.
One of the reasons GDP is so useful is that it's been around for such a long time. It is consistent.
We propose that you add on the missing pieces. Add an estimate of human capital as a one-off set of accounts on one side. Add something on household production. Add something on global supply chains. But you don't clutter up GDP.
Change is hard, I know, but it does help to remember that GDP itself was a new concept once, too. Thanks again to Steve Landfeld. He's the former director of the BEA, Amanda Janew, as well at the Well-Being Economy Alliance. Coming up.
I want to get the community involved.
They do say it takes a village. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials increased 115 points on this Friday, 0.3%, 34,837. The NASDAQ down 3 points, less than 0.1%, finished at 14,031. S&P 500 up 0.8%, 45.15 there. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up 1.4%. The NASDAQ up 3.25%. The S&P 500 ticked up 2.5%. All right, so get this. A new survey from Fannie Mae, the big mortgage conglomerate, shows that despite the old saying about location, 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 neighborhood is no longer the top priority for people shopping for new homes. 36% said affordability was their number one consideration ahead of neighborhood, home quality, or size. Huh. You're listening to Marketplace. Big news. One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. At the risk of belaboring the point, when I said on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday the jobs data was the through line of this economy this week, I really meant the jobs data was the through line of this economy this week. And government jobs data was not the only jobs data. The National Federation of Independent Business put out its own report this week about small business employment. 40% of those small businesses, 40%, said they'd had trouble filling job openings last month, which does sound like a lot, I grant you, 40%, but it's actually the lowest that reading has been since March of 2021. Similar story with wages. The number of business owners who said they raised pay is at its lowest level since May of 2021. So Marketplace's Justin Ho did what he does best, made some calls to find out what's going on.
Business has slowed down at Fearless Foundry, Madeline Reeves' marketing and consulting firm near Seattle. And so ever since this past April, she's been holding off on making new hires.
As an employer, I don't ever want to be in a position where I can't guarantee somebody work long term.
As a result, Reeves says she's been doing more work herself. And when she does need additional help, she's figured out how to get by without relying on full-time staffers.
Now we're shifting to, rather than having in-house designers, we're having outsourced designers that we work with on a contract basis.
Even though the labor market has been showing signs of loosening, there's still plenty of demand for workers in some industries. Mark Fryer owns two restaurants in Vermont called The Reservoir and The Bench.
The other day I went to try to go to two different delis and bakeries, and both had signs reflecting that they were short-staffed and unable to open.
Fryer says he's still having a hard time finding workers, too. Affordable housing in the region is not easy to come by, and many of his employees are about to go back to school.
We literally changed our sign on the road from an explanation on where to park to basically a full-time hiring sign that's permanent on the building.
Businesses have spent the last few years figuring out how to make do with the staff that they have. Tiffany Turner is the CEO of Adrift Hospitality, which operates several hotels in the Pacific Northwest. She's looking for a chef and an HR manager, but right now she says she can afford to be patient.
Because we're fairly seasonal, we're able to kind of take a breath in September and say, okay, we'll be okay even if we don't fill this for a couple of months.
Turner says her business will be fine through the slow winter season, as long as it's fully staffed by February. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Out in far west Texas, far as in hours away from that state's big cities, there's a fight brewing over plans for a big new natural gas pipeline. There are, of course, already hundreds of thousands of miles of pipelines in Texas. Oil and gas are essentially that state's lifeblood. But the petroleum industry's expansion into new and rural parts of the state is getting some pushback at a time when pipeline opponents across the country are changing tactics and are finding some success at actually blocking some of these projects. Marfa Public Radio's Travis Bubenik has the story.
Earlier this summer, a few dozen West Texans gathered in the tiny town of Van Horn to hear about a proposed pipeline called the Saguaro Connector. Some locals, like Ava Franco Lozano, say this was the first they heard about it. She lives just south of town.
And that's where most of the pipeline's going through. But we're not happy about it because they didn't even advise us or nothing.
Oklahoma-based One Oak wants to build the 48-inch diameter natural gas line through this dusty, isolated corner of the state. It's still a tentative proposal. The company says it hasn't made a, quote, final investment decision. But state records show it's planned to run about a mile from Lozano's home. And she says she's worried
about everything, health issues and property destruction, everything.
Nearby RV park owner Penny Self also opposes the project.
I want to get the community involved, is what I want to do.
Self says she mostly takes issue with where the pipeline would run. This is the only town for miles and miles, and it's surrounded by vast open ranch land.
They could use that land. You know, there's lakes, there's explosions. You know, go further out.
Self found out about the pipeline through the National Group Property Rights and Pipeline Center. The group opposes projects being built through private land without a landowner's consent. In Texas, oil and gas companies have broad leeway to do that, thanks to the power of eminent domain. This happens in other states too, but in Texas, companies can get that power simply by telling state regulators they qualify for it. Rebecca Sales, the founder of the Anti-Pipeline Group.
Why is it okay that this trillion-dollar industry can take your land against your will?
ONEOK didn't respond to an interview request, but in a statement, the Texas Pipeline Association said eminent domain is rarely used for pipelines, and that usually companies negotiate paid deals with landowners based on fair market land values. Texas attorney Charles McFarland, who often works with private property owners, says while that may be true, firms still rely on eminent domain powers to speed up the process.
The pipeline companies certainly at least threaten the exercise of eminent domain often and relatively early on in the process because they simply can't afford to be held up.
Anti-pipeline advocates have had some wins in recent years, from the high-profile canceled Keystone XL pipeline to the lesser-known Palmetto pipeline that was sidelined in 2016 by Georgia lawmakers. Sales says some of this is due to opponents shifting their messaging.
We've had rather conservative ranchers who normally wouldn't really be talking. You know, they say, I don't like tree huggers. Usually what happens is they say, well, actually, you're the only ones fighting for me.
In North Dakota, landowner Susan Doppler has been fighting a planned carbon capture pipeline in her area. She describes her politics as middle conservative.
I'd never dealt with an environmental group before.
Doppler says local environmental advocates helped push state regulators to block that pipeline for now.
Thank God for them because they brought us together. They united us so we carried some authority.
But the oil and gas industry has plenty of wins, too. The U.S. Supreme Court recently allowed the controversial Mountain Valley Pipeline in the Northeast to move forward. In Van Horn, the Saguaro Connector project remains in limbo for now as the company waits for regulatory approvals. In West Texas, I'm Travis Bubinick for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, which I kind of love. Saw it on Bloomberg that the Caribbean island of Anguilla might be in for a windfall. Its internet domain, those letters after the dot, as in marketplace.org, its internet domain is AI. So you see where this is going, right? Bloomberg reports the British territory could be in for as much as $30 million this year in domain fees from artificial intelligence startups looking to end their websites with .ai. All right, off we go. Not, however, without your moment of economic context. One last jobs data point to end the week. The overall unemployment rate rose last month, as you know, 3.8%, as we said. The unemployment rate for Black Americans in August, it fell actually a lot from 5.8% to 5.3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is vice president and general manager of Marketplace Worldwide Productions. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday. Everybody have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.